So today, I'm going to follow the example of my good friend Tim. I don't normally do this, but he does this a lot. And I'm going to start with a question. Where is your battleground? Where is your spiritual battleground, right? Is it only the things that you can see, only the things that you interact with, or is it all inside of you? You know, the Bible is full of many analogies that the Christian walk is like a Bible, or is like a battle. You know, we see analogies throughout the Bible, and there's lots of them. There's races, there's battles, but when we look at this, you know, one of them is that the Christian walk is a battle. It's a spiritual battle, and to win a battle, we need to know clearly where the battleground is. Right? You don't have to be a great tactician or a great general to know that if your army is off fighting somewhere else that's not important, that when an important battle comes and the enemy shows up, you're not likely to win, right? If your focus is somewhere else, you're not likely to come through that battle successfully. And this is probably a very easy question to answer, right? You know, I'm sure everyone would answer it the same way, right? The battle is inside of us. But this is a question that's much harder to do than it is to just answer. You know, notice the question that I didn't ask is, where should your battleground be? Because that's the one we could all answer very easily. And there's a big difference here between where it should be and where it is. And it can make all the difference for us, as we'll see. To start with, on this question, I just want to give a simple example. It's an example I'm very familiar with. And I'm sure if either as a parent or as a child, you've experienced this, and I've been on both sides. But, you know, how many situations have you seen or even been in when you were younger where you'd have two kids, right? And they're starting off having some fun, some game they've made up, or, you know, just going about having fun. And then what can quickly turn into? Wrestling match, tears, shoving, accusations starting to fly about who started it or who did the worst thing. And then, of course, you know, when a parent intercedes, what happens? Justification starts coming out. Well, this person did this. This person did this. And it's funny because I don't think Finn and Owen are here, or maybe they are. I had been thinking about this message for a while, and Finn knows this very well. But even this morning, a great line from Finn. They were fairly rowdy inside, so we sent them outside. They started having fun. You could hear the laughters and then the yelling and some other things. And Finn, you know, comes in trouble, and what does he say? He said, well, if you would have let me stay inside, I wouldn't have gotten in trouble. But we know that's not true, don't we, Finn? We know what would have happened. But, you know, not to pick on Finn. Hopefully he's not getting too embarrassed. But we're all like that, aren't we? Right? We start to make justifications. We say, well, this happened, or if only this, I wouldn't have acted like that. You know, because as we start to justify things, it almost always comes down to someone did something to me to make me act that way. Right? And back to the question of saying, you know, how a child is responding to that question, they're essentially saying my battleground is external to me. Right? They're saying I have to fight all these external things that are happening to me so that I don't do the wrong thing. That they're forced to act the way they did because of something external to them. And it's very telling that children behave this way very naturally. You know, you don't teach them to respond that way. At the youngest age, they start to behave that way. And, you know, maybe they pick it up from a sibling or, you know, from examples a little bit, but it's very much their nature, right? It's very much just how they respond. That's the instinctual thing that they do. And even from the first sin, right? What happened? Adam blamed Eve. Eve blamed the serpent, right? No one had ever sinned before. They had no example to follow, but that's what they did. The very first thing that they did is they reached out and they started to blame external forces. So no one taught them to do this. It's just how their human nature responded. And in this case, factually, they were correct. And they could, you know, use that as justification because that's where they saw the battleground as, outside of themselves. Some external force was acting on them, and they responded, and that's why they did. Right? I mean, remember what Adam said. Adam said, "The woman who you gave to me, or to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I ate." That was 100% factual. What did Eve say? Eve said, "The serpent deceived me, and I ate." Again, 100% factual. And you know, in this example of kids, you know, you're having this discussion, and again, I was probably 10 times worse than Finn, so no dispersion on him, but he might have been right. Like, if I would have let him keep doing what he was doing, he wouldn't have done that exact thing, right? Or you know, this person started it, well, this person did this, well, this person did that. Those are all factual statements. They're true, right? They're not lies per se, but they miss the point, of course, right? Because what we'll do is we'll continue to cast blame until we've fully justified our behavior. And while sometimes we'll lie, a lot of times we'll say true statements to cast that blame. You know, some of you might remember a comedian, Flip Wilson. I don't know how many people remember Flip Wilson. Okay, quite a few. I knew of him a little bit, and this is, you know, he was very famous for this line, but he did skits on various shows, and these often included the phrase, "The devil made me do it," right? And of course, that's what essentially Eve was saying, and in some ways, even Adam was saying, right? Well, Eve did it. Eve was caused by devil, so the devil made me do it. Yeah, and he had this character, Geraldine, who he often portrayed. And it would be, you know, she'd get in some kind of a fix, or she would, you know, do some misbehavior, and she would lament. You know, and if you watched it, she was very serious about it. Like, she was convicted that the devil had made her do that misbehavior, that misdeed. Right? Because that's what we want to do. We want to look outside of ourselves and be able to cast the blame outside of ourselves. We want to be able to, you know, explain, use reason on, this is why I did what I did. And, you know, it's possible. It's true. We can always fall back on the ultimate tempter to say why we did what we did. Right? He's out there. We know he's out there all the time trying to tempt us, trying to make us go astray, to miss the mark, to break with God. But if we do that, even if it's factually true, it's missing the point, isn't it? It's missing the point, because those are just justifications. They're rationale. They're not the root cause of the issue, right? They're not the root of what happens. And we know, in this example of kids, we know exactly where this quarrel comes from. We can read it in James 4:1. It says, "What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you?" And that's, you know, where I got the question from. Do you know where your battle is? Because if you ask the people that are fighting and quarreling, they'll probably say the battle is the fighting and the quarreling, right? That's where they're fighting. That's where they're battling. But James here is telling us that when we do that, and we all do it, when we do it, we miss the point. We miss the mark. We miss the root cause of the issue, because the root cause of the issue is what's inside of us, not what's outside of us. Right? Because, again, two kids quarreling, one of them probably started it. Then it started to escalate by going back and forth until it, you know, ends with somebody stepping in. That's factually true. But again, the real answer of why kids fight and quarrel, why we fight and quarrel, is because we have desires inside of us. We want to be viewed as the best. We want to win, right? We want to be bigger or stronger than the person beside us, right? That's the desire that bubbles up, especially in young boys, right? Is that desire. And that's what causes the fight and the quarreling. But it's not just that, right? It's broader than that. We have all kinds of battles we're facing. And it's very easy to constantly look at the outside pressures that are coming on us and think that's the battle that we have to win, that's the battle that we're fighting. But it's not. You know, our faults and our sins, they're not caused by external forces, right? Adam and Eve didn't have external forces except for Satan really pressuring against them. Satan had no external forces. Even Cain and Abel, you know, they probably lived a pretty sheltered life, you could say. There was only four people at the time, but still they sinned. Right? It's not these external forces, these external pressures. It's what lives inside of us. You know, two statements that can help us identify where we think our battleground is are these two, and see which one you identify most with. So the first one is, I am fundamentally a fallen person who sins primarily because of my own sinful nature. That's one way you can respond and you can think when you do sin. Or what about another one? I'm fundamentally a good person who sins primarily because I've been negatively influenced by the environment. Right? What did Adam and Eve say when they responded to God? They essentially said, I'm a fundamentally good person, but who sinned because of some external force. Eve because of Satan, Adam because of Eve. But, you know, before you kind of lock in your answer, right? Just based off of head knowledge, think about what your actual answer is based off of how you direct your emotions, your actions in the heat of battle. Right? Because I'm sure if I ask Ben when he's not engaged in, you know, a tiff, he will say, yeah, I do the wrong thing. I know I do the wrong thing sometimes. I know I shouldn't. But when he's in the heat of battle, what does he see? He sees that battle is not within himself. It's not to control himself. He sees it as that external pressure that he has to fight back against, that external action. And, you know, as I say, many kids can probably give the right answer. But the problem is not being able to know the right answer. It's being able to do it when you get into the heat of battle, so to speak. So when you see yourself as someone whose sinful nature is caused by you, by, you know, your sin, you know that the battleground is within yourself. If you would be one of those kids that you probably wouldn't be any more or less likely to fight. But when broken up, you would respond in a very different way. You would say, you know, I got angry, or I was prideful, or I was this or that, and that's what caused me to fight. Right? Because as humans, we're going to sin. We're going to have those battles. We're going to have to fight them. And we're not always going to, you know, win at the very beginning. But what God is looking for is somebody who's starting to act and think like what James tells us, that the battle is within ourselves, that we still might fight, we might quarrel, but we can look within ourselves and understand it's our own human nature that's the cause of it. But and when you do that, what starts to happen? You start to become very humble. You start to understand where the problem is, how deep it is, how hard it is to change, right? Because who's the only person that can change your heart? Who's the only person that can change your mind? It's only you paired with Christ, with the Holy Spirit, with God. It's the only way that it can happen. But what can happen if you only focus on changing the external area, external environment? You don't necessarily need God, right? Like, you can stand up and walk away. But will walk away solve the problem? Maybe the here and now problem, but it won't solve the root cause, which is your own nature, your own human nature. And if you're one of if you're a person that sees, you know, your environment as what causes you to sin, your answer will most likely be much like the child. You know, it might be more sophisticated because you've learned how to couch it in better terms, not quite so clear, but it's going to seem more like how a child would answer. You'll be able to cast blame, or you will cast blame on other people. You'll say, this happened or that happened, and that's why I did what I did. You know, to start looking at this even more clearly, let's take two examples. We'll take David and Saul. You know, because here are two kings of Israel, the first two kings of Israel, and they both sinned, right? Again, this is not about whether you sin or not. This is how you respond when you understand you did the wrong thing. Because both of them not only sinned, but they were confronted with their sins by prophets of God. But the response was very different. Very, very different. You know, and we know these two stories, but I want to just read, you know, how they responded, the words that they used to respond, because you can see two very different mindsets. One who knows his battle is within himself, and the other that thinks his battle is outside of him, that it's the external pressures that he had, which was his battle. You know, of course, we know David. What did he do? He didn't blame Bathsheba, right? He didn't blame his other wives for lack of attention or anything like that. He didn't blame society for the fact that they, you know, held him in high esteem as this great king, this leader from God, right? He didn't blame any of those things. He didn't even blame Satan for tempting him. What did he say? He clearly went to God and told him that he had sinned, that it was his sinful nature that had caused him to sin, that he'd only sinned against God. Here, we'll just read, and we know this well, but just listen to the words and how he focuses the attention of the words. This is in Psalms 51, verse 2. It says, "Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity." Like, my iniquity. He's taking ownership of the fact that he had sinned. He wasn't blaming anyone else. He wasn't saying this other thing or this other person was responsible for my sin. He was saying it's mine. I own it. Now, he didn't, you know, at that point, I'm sure he didn't want it. He knew he had done wrong, but he still owned the sin. And it says, "And cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is always with me." Now, there'll be an interesting parallel that I'll touch on with Saul here. Saul, when we get to him, but you know, he does. David here acknowledges his transgression, but Saul did as well, as we'll see. But Saul didn't take ownership of the fact that he had caused his own sin. And it goes on, it says, "And my sin is always before me. Against you and you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight, that you may be found just when you speak and blameless when you judge. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity." Right? He understood that it was his nature to sin, that it was something that he had to constantly work on, constantly battle on or battle against. "And in sin, my mother conceived me." Now, of course, that doesn't mean, you know, the English is a little bit awkward there. It doesn't mean that he was conceived in sin per se. It means that his very nature, that as soon as he was conceived, he had a sinful nature because he was human, as we all are. And dropping down to Psalms 51, verse 10, it says, notice what then David says. He says, "Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation, and uphold me by your generous spirit." Notice his focus, right? He clearly acknowledged that he had sinned, and his focus wasn't that he be made, that he looked like he's been clean, that he looks good. His focus is that God and their relationship not be broken, right? This is the, you know, right after he acknowledges this sin, the next thing he does is he says, "Make sure, God, that our relationship can come back together, that we can come back and be one," right? That's what his focus is after his sin. And he goes on and he says in verse 16, it says, "For you do not desire sacrifice, or else I would give it. You do not delight in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise." Again, he knows that to win this battle, he has to go inside of himself. He has to have a broken heart, a contrite spirit. He has to focus on the inside, not the things that, you know, he factually could justify had caused him to sin. No, he knew that it was the inward man that was broken here. He knew that his battle was with his own nature. He knew that he was fundamentally sinful, right? That's what he talked about when he was conceived in sin, that he was fundamentally sinful. And only with God creating that clean heart, a steadfast spirit, would he be able to overcome his true battle, the most important battle that he had. Because remember, what was David? If David was nothing, he was a warrior. You know, how easily could he have gotten distracted? And in some ways you could say maybe he did, with his sin in Bathsheba, get distracted by all the physical battles that he fought, right? He fought real battles. He fought lions. He fought bears. He fought Goliath. He fought the Philistines, the Jebusites, the Amalekites, the Amorites, the Syrians, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Sahobians, like maybe more. Like that was his whole life. He was, you know, God said he was a bloody man because of all the battles that he fought. So he fought many external battles. But we know from God's word that David was clear who really fought and won those battles. You know, because from all indications we have from scriptures, he never lost a battle. We don't ever see him losing a battle from what I can recall. He wins them all, right? And so he easily could have thought those were his battles. But what did he say at the very beginning, 1 Samuel 17:37, when he goes, or when Goliath is against the armies of King Saul and Israel? What does he say? He says, "Moreover, David said, 'The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine.'" Right? He knew that, yes, he was physically in the battle, but it was God who was delivering him. That his battle ground wasn't the physical nature. That was where God was fighting and winning, using David as an instrument, but God was fighting and winning in the physical realm. He understood that his battleground was internal, that was his sinful nature, and that's where he put his focus. That's where he looked to God to help him overcome. But what about Saul, right? His predecessor, the one that he'd grown up watching, that he had served. Saul won victories as well, right? He won physical victories to begin with before his sin. But when the time came, he was clear where he thought his battleground was. He was clear that he thought he was fundamentally a good person who only sinned because of negative influences from his environment, as we'll see. He viewed his battle as outside of himself, with all the pressures that were on him. You know, I'm sure we loosely remember the story, but this is in 1 Samuel 15. It says, well, I won't read it, but just, you know, what happens is God comes to Samuel and tells Samuel to send Saul to completely destroy the Amalekites for what they had done to Israel as they were coming out of Egypt. And the Lord gave clear command, very clear command. It says, to utterly destroy all that they have and do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. And there's, you know, maybe another example of a verse that can be hard to understand, but that's what God told him to do, right? God was very clear. And what did Saul do? He went and he won the victory. But he didn't follow the Lord's commands exactly. Kind of picking up in 1 Samuel 15 and 13, we'll compare the response that Saul had to Samuel when he's confronted by his sin. And again, this is very similar to what David encountered when David was confronted with his sin by Nathan. Right, so very similar parallels. Kings who had sinned, and then a prophet of God came to them and revealed their sin. We saw what David did. David fasted and prayed and you know, looked inwardly and understood, you know, wrote passionate psalm about what had happened, what had gone wrong, and how he needed to fix himself. And it's exactly, you know, what I wanted to focus on, because why David, even in his sin, was called a man after God's own heart, and why Saul was rejected as king is exactly this response. You look at these two responses and you can clearly see why David was a man after God's own heart and Saul was rejected as king. Because, you know, in both cases, they probably knew the right answer. But when it came to the heat of battle, right, when it came to a prophet coming to them, telling them their sins, the response showed what was in their heart, showed what was in their mind, and showed how they viewed their battle. Because, you know, when we know the right thing, it can be easy to twist it so that it sounds right. But it's really hard to fully make it apply the same way that God would. So let's read here in 1 Samuel 15:13, and just notice the difference. It says, "Then Samuel went to Saul, and Saul said to him, 'Blessed are you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord.'" Here's a man who just sinned. But what did he think? He truly thought he had followed the commands of God, at least enough for God to be happy with him. And it goes on, it says in verse 14, "But Samuel said, 'What then is that this bleating of the sheep in my ear and the lowering of the ox which I hear?' And Saul said," what was his response? Was his response like David, where he said, "That was my own personal failing, that was my sin"? No, read what he says. Here, the king of Israel, he says, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed." So what we see two interesting things here. One, even though he was the king, even though he was the one in charge, he blamed the people for doing this. And then not only that did he blame the people, he starts to justify. He said, "But we're really trying to please God because we're going to sacrifice to him." Now, what did David say? David clearly said, "I know you don't want sacrifices. I know you want a contrite heart." And what is Saul saying? "I sinned against your command because I thought you would want some animals for us to sacrifice." This is the difference between their answers, right? And then Samuel gives Saul an earful on his answer, right? Similar to maybe what a parent would give a child when they come and start to justify. And then Saul's response is to double down. And this is in 1 Samuel 15:20. And Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me. And I brought back Agag, king of the Amalekites. I've utterly destroyed the Amalekites." See, there's some confusion here because he didn't utterly destroy the Amalekites because he at least brought back the king and he brought back sheep and he brought back oxen. It says, and again, and Saul, or Samuel had told him, you know, don't use the excuse that the people made you do it. But what does Saul come back and repeat? He says, "But the people took of the plunder, sheep of oxen, and the best of the things which should have been. So he knew they should have been utterly destroyed to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. And then again, Samuel makes plain that what Saul did was sinful and contrary to what God commanded. And this is where, you know, Saul's true heart, true nature starts to really come out. Because what does he do? Twice now, or, you know, twice, he's kind of doubled down on the fact that the people made him do it. He followed what God said. He shouldn't be held accountable. And Samuel is clear in that, yes, he was accountable. Then in verse 24, 1 Samuel 15:24, it says, "And then Saul said to Samuel, 'I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandments of the Lord and your word.'" So just like David, he admitted that he'd sinned finally. Right after a couple times, he admitted that he sinned. It says, "Because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord." Now when you just read it, when you just kind of glance over it, you can say, well, Saul confessed. Saul repented. Why did God not forgive him? But his heart starts to be revealed in that last sentence. Because what was David's focus? David confessed his sins, owned his sins. Saul kind of owned his sins. But then once he owned his sin, David's focus was what? to restore his personal relationship with God. What's Saul's? He wants to go worship the Lord in front of all the people. That's what he wanted to do. He didn't worry so much about the personal relationship that he had destroyed. He worried about how he looked to the people. And you can go on and see this in verse 30, where it's truly his heart is shown. In 1 Samuel 15:30, he says, "Then he says, I have sinned." Again, he confesses his sin, but he says, "Yet honor me now, please, before the elders of my people and before Israel, and return with me that I may worship the Lord your God." Do you see the difference between the two? He wanted to win the battle of honor with his people, with his elders. He wanted to win the battle of how he looked. He wanted to win that external battle, whereas David was only focused on his inward heart, the inward relationship that he had destroyed. He wanted to repair it. Saul doesn't even mention his relationship with God. It's a fascinating difference, right? A fascinating compare and contrast, because David was willing to be humbled by having his sin used as an example. Up to this day, David was willing to have his sin used as an example to bring people to God, if only God would change his heart and help him to win the long-term battle, to win the battle against his very nature. That was David's focus. But Saul was only focused on looking honorable to those outside of him, not to God, not his relationship with God, but only to the elders and those, you know, in power, positions of authority. You know, what a contrast from these two kings. We can see why one was rejected and why one was called, you know, a man after God's own heart, even though they both sinned. But again, it's not the sin, because we all sin. It's how you move forward from that sin. It's where you see your battle. Do you see everything external to you, all these pressures that are making you sin, or do you understand that it's truly your heart, your human nature that is causing you to sin, and that only if God will reach in and change that can you now move forward like God expects? You know, and if we're really honest with ourselves, who are we more like? When push comes to shove, right, when things get really hard, who are we more like? David or Saul? Now, this isn't to say we shouldn't, you know, try to order our environment in some way to reduce temptations, right? It's obvious, like a very obvious example is an alcoholic shouldn't have a stocked bar in their house, right? So that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that going back to Adam and Eve, going back to the demons, going back to Satan, they had a nearly perfect environment, but they still sinned, right? Because the sin came not from the environment. It came from their own nature, right? It's not enough, right? Specifically, think about Adam and Eve, right? They're in this near perfect environment. They had one thing that was off limits, and they only had one thing that was tempting them, Satan. Right? So there's really no amount of ordering that we can do to make ourselves safe from sin, because the sin comes from within ourselves. The sin comes inside of us. You know, sometimes I repeat myself a lot, I'm sure, but I think it bears repeating, right? We live in a fallen, sinful world, right? We have a fallen, sinful nature, and no amount of fixing the environment around us, fixing the things that we surround ourselves with, will change our nature. And again, I'm not saying you don't do things to make your environment better. But as we'll see some interesting examples. But it's not about that. It's that we have to understand there's no amount of fixing to our environment that we can do to make our sinful nature not come out. Until our sinful nature has been fixed by God, we'll find a way to sin, no matter how perfect our environment is. You know, and Christ makes plain here what our battleground is. We'll read in Mark 7:14, it says, When he had called all the multitudes to himself, he said to them, "Hear me, everyone, and understand." And this set of scriptures can often, you know, often is used for various things. But when we understand the word picture that Christ is trying to use here, it becomes very clear what he's telling us. Here in verse Mark 7:15, it says, "There is nothing that enters a man from outside which can defile him." Now again, this isn't talking about clean and unclean meats. This isn't, you know, talking about those kind of things. What it's saying is that no matter what environmental pressures you have, you don't have to sin. It's your own sinful nature that responds in that way. It goes on and says, "But the things which come out of him, those are the things that defile a man." Our nature comes out of us and is what defiles us. "If anyone has ears to hear, let him hear. When he had entered a house away from the crowd, his disciples asked him concerning the parable. So he said to them, 'Are you thus without understanding also? Do you not perceive that whatever enters a man from outside cannot defile him? Because it does not enter his heart, but his stomach, and is eliminated, thus purifying all foods.' And he said, 'What comes out of a man, that defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of men,'" and in some ways he's saying it to you and I, "what comes out of you, what comes out of me, without God's Spirit, without God's help, what would come out? This is, out of the heart of men proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these things come from within and defile a man." There's no outside pressure that forces you to respond in these sinful ways. The thing that causes you to respond in these sinful ways, the things that cause me to sin or to sin in these ways, is our natures that have to be changed by God. And Christ makes plain that all these evil things come from within us, right? He was the perfect example of someone who surrounded himself with sin. Think of the people he associated with: tax collectors, prostitutes. He didn't try to keep his environment clean, right? He knew his mission was to come and work with sinful people. But he's the perfect example of someone that no matter what surrounded him, he always was sinless, because he had won that battle, and he continued to fight that battle with God's help throughout his entire life, that his human nature, the same human nature that you and I have, would not win against the Spirit of God, right? That he continued to win this inward battle, that he continued to focus. As I say, especially once he came to his ministry, he didn't worry about the environment he was in. In some ways, he went to the most sinful environments that he could find at the time, because that was who he was sent to help. And you and I, as we mature, are called to do the same thing. Right? You and I can't always be in a perfect environment or an ordered environment where we keep all temptations, all external influences of sin away from us, because we're called to go give that same good news that Christ gave to those who need it the most. Right? And so it's the inward battle that we have to win. It's the inward battle that we have to focus on. And in many ways, it's an eternity question, right? Because if we can't focus here and now on changing our hearts, changing our minds to the ways of God, how are we going to do it for all eternity? Again, yes, it'll be a perfect environment, but it's not the environment that causes you to sin. It's your inward nature. You know, as I said, think about the earliest sins: Satan, the demons, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel. They were all in perfect or near perfect environments, and yet they still sinned, because their problem wasn't the environment. The problem was their nature. Now let's move on to a slightly different variant of this, because, you know, just as we are to look inward to our own hearts and minds, the church is to do the same thing. Right? We can often think as a church our goal is to keep society from leaking, our main purpose is to keep society, you know, focused on God. But as we see, as we'll see, our main focus should be on keeping society from leaking into the church, right? It should be from the outside or from the inside out, that it should be focused on fixing the inside of the church, not necessarily focused so much on the environment that's outside of the church. And the best example of this, the most clearest example is, of course, the church at Corinth, right? What do we know about the church at Corinth? Corinth was a very corrupt society. It was a very wealthy society, but it had a culture of promiscuity, right? We see that culture was one that was there for centuries, even before the church had started. And we'll start in 1 Corinthians 5:1. It says, this is Paul, he's saying, it is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and such sexual immorality as is not even named among the Gentiles, that a man has his father's wife. As I said, so what Paul is saying here is he's saying that the culture had leaked in to the church, that the church had not been focused enough about what was happening inside the church. And it goes on and it says, and you were puffed up and have not rather mourned that he who has done this deed might be taken away from among you. It says, for I indeed, as absent in body but present in spirit, have already judged as though I was present him who has so done this deed. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, when you are gathered together along with my spirit, with the power of our Lord Jesus Christ, deliver such a one to Satan for destruction of the flesh, that his spirit may be saved in the days of the Lord Jesus. Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed, Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Right? This time, days of unleavened bread that we just went through, Paul is focusing us on this time. Because again, the days of unleavened bread, one of the focuses should be, how are we changing from the inside? Right? How are we taking that unleavened bread of Jesus Christ, and how is it changing us like to become like Christ? And it goes on and it says, therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, but with the leaven of, or nor the with the leaven of malice or wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with the sexual immoral people, or with sexually immoral people. And here is going to be the heart of what Paul is saying, right? He's making it very clear that our focus is not to be on the environment around us. It's to be, even as a church, on what's going on inside the church. It says, I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people, yet certainly did not mean with sexually immoral people of this world. He's saying very, very clearly, when I told you that, what I was telling you is to focus not on people outside, because those are the people you're supposed to spread the gospel to. You're supposed to interact with sinners. That whole list of sins that Christ talked about when he talked about the cup, those are the very people that the good news should be preached to, that you have to interact with those people so that they can come to understand Christ, right? That's what we're called to do. We're to take on that mission that God gave to Christ and then Christ gave to us. So Paul's saying, he said, you misunderstood what I said when I said don't associate yourselves with immoral people. What I meant was don't associate with immoral people inside the church. And we'll see. It goes on. It says, yet I certainly did not mean with sexually immoral people of the world, or with covetous or extortioners or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. Right? The sin that we are not to abide is not the sin of the world, but the sin of the church. Right? They had misunderstood him. Whenever he had first written them, they had misunderstood what he said. And this is, you know, really Paul here is rephrasing Christ's prayer at the end of his life, where he specifically says he doesn't want his followers taken out of the world, right? We know this well, John 17, 15, and 16. I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. He doesn't want us out of the world. He doesn't want us completely taken out of the environment of this world. He wants us protected from Satan. He wants us to watch our hearts, watch our minds, but he doesn't want us taken out of the world, right? Because to follow Christ's example of taking the gospel to the world, what are we going to have to do? We're going to have to preach to those, interact with those that most need it. So in some ways, the most sinful people are who we are to interact with. But that's external environment, not internal. And it goes on, and Paul goes on and says in 1 Corinthians 5:11, it says, "But now I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother." So very clearly that the sins we are not to abide in the church, much like the sins we are not to abide in ourselves, are the things that are within us, that we can't always protect ourselves, that we're not supposed to protect our environment all the time, because those are forces that we have to learn to overcome. Because again, it's that which comes from inside of us that is the problem, not that which interacts with us. And he goes on, he says, "But now I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother who is sexually immoral or covetous or an idolater or a reveler or a drunkard or an extortioner, not even to eat with such a person. For what have I to do with judging those who are outside?" Again, think of this concept both as a church but also as an individual. What do you have to do to judge that which is outside of you? What do we as a church have to do to judge or have to do with judging those that are outside of us? It says, "Do you not judge those who are inside?" As a church, do we judge those that are inside? Is that our focus, or judging those that are outside? As an individual, do we judge what's inside, or do we judge what's outside? This is what Paul is saying, and we can apply it, as they say, in different levels. It says, "But those who are outside, God judges." Is that not true, both as a church, but also as an individual? If someone comes and sins against you, who judges that? Who will judge that? God will. You don't have to. What do you have to do? You have to judge your response. You have to judge how well you did in holding back your human nature, how well God's Spirit is working within you to defeat that human nature that's within inside you. That's what you have to judge. That's where your focus has to be. That's where your battleground has to be. It has to be inside. And as a church, our battleground is not everything going around in the world around us, but it's what's going on within the church. You know, have we purified it with God's Spirit in the way that God would have us? That has to be our focus. You know, Paul very clearly tells us, he says, "Look inward, take care of your own body," the body of Jesus Christ, right? The church in this case, but it applies to each and every one of us individually. And as I began with, brethren, we must know where our battlegrounds lie, both individually and as a church. If we don't, we'll be fighting some other battle and not even understand the critical one that's going on, right? Too often, people get focused on the things that are outside of them and lose focus on what's inside. And it's a battle. It's a struggle for what's going on inside, right? It's not an easy fight. You look at the examples. You know, I'd given a message a while ago about Abraham, about David, about Paul. Years into their journey as followers of God, and they were still struggling. They were still falling short. That's how tough a battle, how hard fought it's going to be for us to go through life, always keeping our eye towards God, always keeping our human nature in check. And of course, we can only do it with the Holy Spirit working within us, right? This is David crying out to God, saying, "Fix my heart," focusing not what's on the outside of the cup, but focusing what's on the inside. But knowing this is not enough. As I said at the beginning, the question isn't Do you know where your battleground should be? The question is, do you know where your battleground is? Where are you fighting? Right? Because knowing is not enough. It has to be where we put our passion, where we put our focus, where we put our efforts, where we put our prayers. Where do you put those things? Do you put those things on what's happening on the inside or what's happening around you? That's how you start to know where your battleground is. And if needed, you know you have to shift it, that you have to shift that focus back to where it should be, which is inside of you. Because it's in our nature, right? It's in our nature to blame the environment around us. We see that from the very beginning. Even Satan himself blamed his environment. Could you imagine? Satan was in a perfect environment, created, you know, at the very beginning by God, completely without sin, and yet Satan blamed his environment for his sin. And the same would be for us if we were in that same environment, because the problem is not our environment. The problem is us. It's our sinful nature. But God, you know, will be in that battle with us. Much like David said as he, you know, fought physical battles, it's God who will deliver us. God will bring us through our battles. But he does expect us to guard our hearts and our minds, to focus on what's coming from the inside of us. But with his Spirit, it is a battle that he has promised that we will fight and win.